Hello, and welcome to another episode of Right Care Baptist. I'm Jake Lancaster, an internal medicine physician and the chief medical officer for the Baptist Medical Group.
And I'm Amanda Comer. I'm a nurse practitioner and the chief advanced practice officer.
And today we're excited to have on one of our repeat guests, the esteemed Dr. Steve Threkeld, to talk about his unique experience with a New England Journal of Medicine case conference series. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. Nice to be with you guys.
I know you've been on this about, 50 times now. You're our highest numbered guest, but just for the rare individual that does not know you, can you tell them a little bit of your background?
Sure. I'm Steve Threkeld, and I'm an infectious disease physician here at Baptist. Grew up in the Memphis area and went off to do all my training, moved back for free babysitting and to join my brother in practice. And Ahmad Omer joined us about 25 years ago, and we've added a couple of people since. So we're in practice, and I also have worked a lot with the hospital and am the medical director for infectious disease for Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Well, you've really undersold it. What we're about to talk about is this unique honor, really, that you were asked to do last year with the New England Journal of Medicine, Mass General Hospital. Can you tell us just a little bit about that process? Tell us a little bit about what you were asked to do.
Sure. It's the an article, this an ongoing article in the New England Journal since I've forgotten the year, to the 20s, something like that. And it's called Case Records of the Massachusetts General Hospital. And it's basically a case unknown that they have a talk about. And it's roughly a weekly article. There are a few articles with a few weeks that they have other substitutions. But it's most weeks. And it's kind of a comprehensive presentation of a generally complicated case. And so they'll present the case, and the people that were involved will talk about the case. The radiologists will prevent those. Will present those findings, EKG findings, all of those things, and then the discussant will give their take on the case for 10, 15 minutes, whatever that is, and give a differential diagnosis and go through the thought process of how they would have approached that case. It's notable that they're not involved in that case. They don't know the answer until you find out the answer at the end of it. So it's a little harrowing to do it. And then in the end, after you have discussed the case, they will go over the important findings, whether it be cultures or pathology. They'll go over a postmortem examination if one was done. And then they'll have the caregivers that were actually involved in the case discuss the case a bit. And then it kind of ends with the final diagnosis, which is the kind of the end of the presentation, the article.
Wow, that sounds really, really interesting. So tell me, how does one get, asked or appointed to be a part of this?
A short straw, I think, actually.
Okay.
No, it's, it is, I happen to, the section editor for the case records article is a old friend who was a year behind me in training, and so he'd asked me to do it twice during COVID, and it just for all of us who lived through that, there just was just no time to do it, and so I had to kind of turn him down twice, and so I knew this would be the last time that somebody would ask. And so my big sister and mentor, a lady named Nestle Bashkaz, who is the clinical head at Mass General Hospital, she runs the yearly infectious disease in adults, the Harvard Medical School Review course. And so every year in that course, they have a live CPC as opposed to a conference at the hospital where it usually is. And so it's a Zoom conference for the people that participate nationally. And so we just had the conference over Zoom in a similar kind of situation.
So are all the cases within that one hospital, or are you able to?
Yes. What happens is a particular case that's interesting or maybe rare, maybe sometimes a classic version of something will happen at Mass General. And then the chief medical residents typically cull those cases and say, this would be a good case for a CPC. And it'll take about a year, really, for that to go through the process of kind of creating the protocol to present to the discussant and getting everybody together to do it. And then they present the protocol to the discussant a few months before the conference, that you have to work on it. And then you have the conference, and it takes about 6 months to get it to press. So it's kind of a slow process, really. But I had the opportunity to participate in one when I was a fellow. It was a newborn, And so I was able to comment as a person that actually participated in the care of the patient. It's kind of a sad story that the child was born with malignant histiocytosis, and he really didn't survive for very many days. But a friend of mine and I were on call, and so we took a slide from one of the skin lesions that really would have made the diagnosis. And it was kind of sad because we took a scraping and actually took the photos that were in the article. And we took it back to the infectious disease lab, and we looked under the microscope, and we had no idea what we were looking at. It looked sort of almost like a herpetic, a zinc prep almost looking thing. And so we said, well, we're going to take this to the pathologist in the morning and find out what this is and be able to help and tell the family what this is, and I think that'll be of some help. And the one day in the 3 years that I was there, they cleaned up the micro lab up in the thing, and they threw the slide away by the time we got the next morning. So we weren't able to, you know, we didn't really know the diagnosis until later at post. So it's kind of a sad finding. But so anyway, a lot of work goes through into it with a lot of people who are participating in the case along the way.
But it sounds like you've been a part of this process several times over your career, or at least intimate with the process.
Well, I mean, I was a fellow at MGH from 94 through 97, so did participate in a couple of the cases at that time, just peripherally as a person who was taking care of the patient involved. Yeah.
And how do they decide who to choose for a case?
You know, I think it just depends on the person who, for example, in this case, Nestle Bashkaz was kind enough to call me because she was kind of in charge of that conference. And I think Eric Rosenberg, the section editor, will frequently farm it out. And what they'll do is they'll, not all cases, of course, are infectious disease. They're orthopedic ones, and a lot are, it seems, but they're autoimmune things and pulmonary things and cardiac things. And so those people that might be the specialist involved in the case might pick somebody. And usually it's someone who's actually still at Harvard Med School or one of their institutions, but sometimes they'll ask people who've been there or know the folks from years past.
But they're not just choosing any random doctor off the street to come do this conference.
Sadly, no. Sadly, no.
So they do give you information to prep.
Oh, yes. You have a protocol in the case. So they send you the case as it presents in the article, actually, throughout, and you get to look at that. And I'll never forget, I was standing on cardiac transplant rounds about 8 o'clock one morning when the email came through with this case, and I looked at it. And I checked my calendar to make sure it wasn't April 1st because it was ruthless. It was a very difficult case, really. And so I looked at it. I was like, okay, this is a joke. And the lady started out with a history of schistosomiasis and growing up in Brazil. And that's a tough start for a case. But so they email you that, and they email you the EKGs, they email you the x-rays that you can look at. And it is, as they say, an open book exam. So you can call or talk to anybody you want to, including the people there. You can call and clarify things. So there are things about the history that I was able to call and say, okay, now this doesn't make sense to me. And they would go back and talk to the people that were involved directly and make a few changes sometimes in the protocol. And that became very helpful to me in the end. But I was talking with Jake earlier, that there was a guy from UAB where Jake and I both trained at one point in our careers, named Dr. Kreisberg, who did CPCs fairly regularly there. And he actually would come into the conference without any prep, and he refused to get the protocol before we all walked in to discuss it. He got it when the people in the conference got it. And at the time, I was always... It just brought anxiety to me to even think about such a thing, and no more than right now, I can tell you, that somebody would have been able to do that.
No, I mean, for those that haven't gotten the message, these aren't just your typical run-of-the-mill cases. These are unique cases, difficult-to-diagnose cases, a notoriously hard case series that he was asked to do. So with that in mind, can you just walk us a little bit through the vignette of what the case was? I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty details because yeah. It's we might lose
too
some,
painful to
recall some of the audience, but just a brief one-liner, and then why is this particular case stood out to you as being unique and difficult?
Yeah, I think that so it's a young to middle-aged kind of lady who lived in the Boston area, but was an expatriate from Brazil, grew up there. And, she had schistosomiasis, a parasitic disease, probably as a child and a much younger adult, and developed significant liver disease from that, which is one of the complications of that disease. But had eventually been treated for it. And then she had come to the United States and had a few medical problems along the way, fairly advanced liver disease, it turns out. And then she went back for presumably a fairly extended trip to back to Brazil. And it was a rural, coastal, marshy part of Brazil where her family had had been. It's a very high rate of mosquito-borne, like dengue type of illnesses. So she was exposed to a great many things. Malaria, certainly in Brazil, but not as much in that particular area. So she was exposed to a lot of stuff. And then she came back from that trip of uncertain duration, but presumably quite a while. And as soon as she got back, she began to feel kind of bad, had some stomach illness and she leg pain. And she just, over the next 3 or 4 days, became critically ill, presented to the hospital. The protocol didn't tell us this, but it was pretty obvious that she was not going to survive based on the presentation. And in fact, she did die within 24 hours of the description of the case. So she only survived a day or two at the hospital even. So I think that the hard part was that there was just so much in the way of epidemiologic stuff. There was a tremendous amount of kind of what turned out to be noise, really, but you can't really know that when you look at it. So I felt really, really persecuted when, during the process of slaving through this and pulling my hair out and being anxious, I went to my mailbox one night and I got the New England Journal. I looked at the CPC, and it was like a case of chicken pox that you could sort of see what it was after three lines and looking at the picture. I was like, come on. And so, yeah.
So you got a case where it literally could have been 100 different things that this patient could have.
You know, it really was a lot of different stuff. And I certainly was not, and we can talk about AI involved in these kinds of things and medicine in general, because heaven knows I utilized it in these kind of things. But, you know, I would call, you can call anybody you want in discussing this. So I talked to a lot of people about it, certainly, and people who I thought are very talented. And most of them kind of went, well, gosh, yeah, that's tough. Good luck kind of thing. So there were a lot of possibilities, I think, that could have accounted for her illness and death.
So you talked a lot about noise making this case particularly challenging. Do you have any recommendations in throughout the day for our medical staff how to dampen that noise?
Yeah, I think today's healthcare is very different, even from when I started. There's less time. There are more patients you're responsible for. There are more tests available. And I think if anything has been lost during my years in clinical medicine, it's just taking the history. I mean, all too often we'll see the ER person given the most detailed history, and then that kind of gets echoed throughout a chart. And that's everywhere. I think that has been a trend. So I think there's an old saying, and I don't know who said it, but the three most important elements of the physical exam are the history, and the history. And so I think when you sit down and talk to a patient now, the cliche is they'll frequently tell you what's wrong with them. And I just think that the way medicine has evolved in recent years, there are a couple of things. You know, that it used to be, I mean, primary care is not what it once was. There's less of it. It's less extensive. And so when people come to the hospitals with a complicated illness, you know, when I started out, you'd get a call from the primary doctor and say, okay, this is my patient. They have this problem. This is what they've been through. And this is what's happened recently. And here are my thoughts. And so you had a lot more to go on. Here, now, in this age, fewer people get primary care. The hospital emergency department is the primary care clinic in a lot of senses all across this country. And so we have people that we really have no information on, and you have to go get it. And I think that's really the now, in this case, you know, you're presented it in mass, just how much they wanted you to have. And so in the noise reference really is there were so many epidemiologic factors. But if you don't ask those questions, you don't know about some of those things that might play a big role, you know, in these illnesses.
Yeah. Was it like 90% of cases should be able to be diagnosed from the history alone is what I hear.
That's what they say.
What was it the case in this case, or was there some lab or radiologic study?
No, in fact, I would have missed this case if it weren't for further discussions about it kind of with some of the people involved. The a catastrophic illness and death with disseminated intravascular coagulation, DIC, and just florid sepsis. And of course, we didn't have any cultures. They came back 6 hours after the information stops for us, you know, in the presentation of the case. But you know, there were just a lot of there were a lot of issues that that you can't really know based on just the history. And people that come in and die within 24 hours in the hospital, you know, there is a limited differential, but it's very hard to tell which it is. And on the basis of so much epidemiologic information, my first love as a diagnosis here was dengue hemorrhagic fever, because she was in an area that's greatly increased in dengue fever. You have to have dengue twice to get dengue hemorrhagic fever, and she would have grown up there and had it. There are four different types, and you've got to have one and then have a different one to get that. And it is an illness that can take you from okay and just sort of sick to absolutely critically ill and dying in 24 hours. And in talking to some of the folks there, you know, the one thing that probably didn't fit was the fact that the white count shot up greatly. And that's really uncommon, though reported, mind you, but it's uncommon in any kind of viral illness, and dengue included. And so that really left us with sort of the other things that cause acute sepsis and death. And most of those are gram-negative organisms, which one I didn't specify in the end. And I think it was difficult to know that in the end exactly what it was.
So talk a little bit more about the process. You got the protocol. How long until you felt confident you knew the answer to the case?
Oh, I never felt confident. It was brutal in that regard. I mean, I was thankfully able to contact some old friends and connections from other friends, and talk to a lot of people with a lot of expertise in these areas. And
so, you're telling us that you got the protocol, and that there's a lot of different things that were going through your mind about what it could be. Did you do any sort of reading on the differential, like dengue fever and what other things, or did you know all of that going into the case?
No, it was a very large body of possibilities. And so, read a lot. And it is, as I mentioned, something of an open book exam. You can read anything. You can call anybody you want. You can enlist the aid of your peers. And I called in any favor I may have had from my life before then, and talked to just a lot of people about it. And it's just a very broad differential. And I think the problem is that you really, when you could narrow it down to 5 or 10 things. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it was very difficult to tell between the two. So, I utilized everything that I could find, as the Ted Lasso song, Lord Knows I Tried, or Heaven Knows I Tried. I used AI to check and see, because there's a lot obviously been made about clinical use of AI.
In these particular case conference series, is, you know, what I've read, they're usually better at diagnosing the case than expert physicians.
Yeah, sadly, yes. And so, I think I used every available AI, and I generated free trials for a couple of them. Okay. That I then abandoned just to run this case through them. You know, it's interesting. It gave me a little perspective on how best to use AI. It's not so great at this sort of thing when there are a lot of possibilities at narrowing it down, because it's more like, I've heard described, AI is more like a person you're talking to than it is some sort of machine in that sense, and how it does and how it thinks. And you can influence the AI on what you say and so forth. So if you just feed the protocol, it gave you 10 things, much like most of the experts I talked to in travel medicine and geographic medicine, that sort of thing. Like, well, it could be dengue fever. It could be, you know, gram-negative E. coli sepsis from the gut in a liver disease patient. And really, as I say, it generated kind of the same differential that anybody could generate reading the protocol. It was just large. And so, in part because of my experience with that, I utilize AI now not so much to generate the differential. I think it's very helpful to generate your own differential, and then use AI to make sure you didn't miss thinking about 3 or 4 extra things. I think that's where it's the strongest in my own practice and what I use it for. It's not necessarily just fantastic at taking 5 possibilities and telling you what the best one is. There's been a lot lately in board certification, in the LKA, or longitudinal knowledge assessment for the American Board, and I'm on the Infectious Disease Board Exam Committee, and we write the questions, and there are 8 of us, And so the problem is that people have begun to just take their computer and literally cut and paste the question that they get. It's open book, but not necessarily quite like that. And they feed it into an AI model, and it spits out what it thinks the answer. And the interesting thing about it is, and that's not considered to be kosher, by the way, to do that, trademark violations and all kind of things. But I don't find it to be that great at that sort of thing. And I've, in retrospect, looked at some of those questions. And so AI is not just as fantastic at picking the right answer from a differential diagnosis as it is giving you a broad differential diagnosis. And that really wasn't so much the problem in this case.
No, I think what you said earlier, it can be influenced very easily by how you frame your prompt. It is very good at agreeing with you and making you think you're the smartest doctor in the world because what you asked it was the correct answer, but it doesn't question what you ask it and doesn't. But it can be useful, again, for generating a broad differential, thinking of things you hadn't thought of. But you have to be very careful how you use it.
Absolutely. I think it's, I mean, if I had to sum it up in just a couple of words, it's a differential diagnosis expander for me. And if I just plug it in and then think about the case after I get it, I think not only have you really not gained much, you may have lost something because you're not utilizing your own creativity, your own experience. You can dull your senses about something when you think you have the answer before you thought about it yourself.
Yeah. Well, what triggered, you know, what was it in your research, in your, you know, talking with others, in your AI usage that really got you to, here's why I think it's the answer? What stood out to you?
Yeah, I think there were really a couple of diagnoses. And I, you know, in the paper, I think I said it, gram-negative sepsis, and dengue hemorrhagic fever was my kind of first thought about it. And the thing that, and I talked to that with some of the folks, you know, at the hospital took care of the patient and were in charge of the protocol. And, you know, the white count shooting up like hers did at the very end of her life after she presented to the hospital, that is, it is reported in terrible hemorrhagic fevers like dengue, but it's really quite rare. And that really, I think, is what made kind of the difference in it being more likely a bacterial infection than one of the severe viral infections that she could have encountered. And then it got into things like the period after exposure, you know, things like some of the seawater exposures can be an issue. But the incubation period had been much shorter for those. She was several days when she got really ill. So there were things like that that came into effect. But in the essence, it's somebody with a lot of underlying illnesses, a lot of sort of immune aberrancies, if not deficits, from liver disease that really messes up your ability to stop some kind of germs, particularly if you might have gotten from the gut, the plain old E. coli, or something more a little more exotic like meningococcus. People with liver disease just do a lot worse. And that was, you look at things that can kill somebody in 24 to 48 hours is really what you're really looking at. But under the problem that liver disease can make that more likely to happen also in anybody.
So what was your biggest takeaway from the process?
How to deal with anxiety and pain, I think, was the coping mechanism. No, I think that, you know, in the end, I think that it's still important, and maybe the craft of medicine, we've lost a little bit in the last 20, 30 years. I think that taking a really good history is crucial at digging through the kind of cases that this article usually has. And I've told people before, I mean, one of the real thrills for me of doing this was that I literally remember sitting in my dad's lap as he would look at this particular article. And I remember vividly that when I was a little kid. So it's been around for a long time. Just how to present a case. I mean, I use this article myself as an educational tool, and a lot of people do, just how to present a case, because we've kind of lost a little of that too. You know, the way people present cases now is they say, okay, this is a middle-aged person with the following 20 problems in their lives, and they list off 20 things a person's had. That's not really the way you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to only talk about those things that are relevant to what's wrong with them now.
And sounds like Glenn Cobb speaking.
It is absolutely echoes of Glenn Cobb, whom I talked to about this case, the former ID chief at UAB that Dr. Lancaster and I both encountered heavily in our past. But it's exactly right. And you want to tell the story of what it is. And you, when you present a case, you want to generate that differential for the person you're telling it to. And so that's something I think it's kind of been lost. In this case, example, we talked about the fact that she was had schistosomiasis as a child. That wouldn't be important, except that we know that the liver disease that that generated was a central issue in this and really participated in why it is what it is. So that would be part of the history of presentness in that person. So I think just the craft of medicine and how to go through the differential diagnosis, it definitely reemphasized that to me. And people talk about humbling experiences almost as a cliche. They throw it out there. And I'm going to tell you, this was a humbling experience to have a case you don't know the answer. And it's all about the process. You know, they say it's not whether you get the right answer or not, but I can assure you that you worry about that a little bit along the way, too.
It's a public event, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it's probably one of the widest read, you know, medicine articles in the world. And you don't want to be just badly wrong. And so, as I say, I talked to a lot of people about it. But you know, it was a thrill to do it and fun in its own way. And I think, but it's just that, I think we sometimes need to, focus on the craft of doing things right and how we take histories and stuff, and look at things, sequentially and in an organized kind of fashion. I think in today's rapid fire, medical world, it's hard to do that all the time. And we sort of look at people in batches, and sort of we look at what's wrong with them and we just, boom, try to come to a conclusion. And I think, like this case, I think it's scary in that we probably miss a lot of stuff and we never know what we missed, really. You don't know what you don't know. And I think it's, you know, reading and trying to stay current, it's important because, you know, I worry about that sort of thing. And I know, I mean, Jake does too, I know, and you do too. The people that you encounter, you don't want to miss what's wrong with them because bad things can happen. And it happens every single day in every hospital in America because, you know, we didn't think of something. So you want to be thorough and have a big differential diagnosis, because if it's not in your first differential, it's not going to be in your last one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, something like 10% of all cases are misdiagnosed. So pretty high number, pretty substantial.
Yeah. And it may be a conservative estimate in the first place.
Yeah. But. So, you know, moving on, tell us what you would tell a colleague that got asked to do this. What advice would you give them?
Have as smart a group of friends as you can. I think that's the biggest thing. You know, I think, again, being systematic, and I had the good fortune of a lot of my friends have done this conference. There's a guy named Howard Heller that I talked to about it. He was another one of my mentors. I think he's done 7 of them or something like that. So I called him, of course, and got his wisdom about it. And, you know, it's the same thing that you would, I think, present or that you would approach a case. Listen to what the history is. Don't come at it with a lot of preconceptions. Take the facts and be, you know, use common sense about it. Look and see what it might be. And then, you know, and then you sort of go out from there about some things that might be a little more unusual. But use the facts that you're given. If you take a thorough history, you're gonna come close to what's wrong with them. And yes, you have to read. Yes, you have to know kind of what you're doing about things, and also to get help. I think that's a big deal. If you don't know, I got a lot of help on this, a lot. And so I think that's important. If you don't know the answer to something and you're kind of, and you need the expertise of somebody that has it, I'll talk to some geographic medical people. So read, be thorough in talking to a patient, and then talk to other people about it.
That's good advice. What would you do differently if you were asked to do this again?
I would turn it down. No, I'm kidding. I tried that approach twice. No, my big sister and dear friend asked me to do it. I don't know that I would do a lot differently. I mean, I think I exhausted every possible route of information that I could do. It was stressful. There's no question about that. But yeah, it was in its own way really fun too. So I would ask my wife's permission next time. Is what I would do, I think, before.
Well, that's a really good answer. And you know, any closing comments you want to leave with the audience?
No, I think it. You know, it was a great experience for me, and I was very happy and pleased to represent Baptist. And so it was a fun experience, and I hope we can have somebody else have the opportunity to do it again.
Well, we're certainly lucky to have you here, and we appreciate all you've done for us.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's always great to be with you guys.
And thanks everybody for listening or watching in this case. And remember, if you follow the link in the show notes, you can redeem this episode for CME credit.